29, abandoned ship. Black Stash was in a dark rage. The treasure had been in his hands, in his hands, and now it was in the sea, thrown there by a boy. A boy. Stash had always disliked boys, and the fact that this one had appeared to be flying made him even more unappealing in the pirate's eyes. Stash had seen many things in his pirate career, but never a flying person, and, even in the wild confusion on the wave-washed deck of the Neverland, it nagged at him. Maybe he wasn't really flying. Maybe it was a trick played by the wind. Whatever the explanation for the boy, Stash was sure it had something to do with the trunk, which was now in the sea. This fact made Black Stash so angry he could barely think. He wanted very much to soothe his nerves by killing somebody, perhaps several people, ideally including a boy. But there simply wasn't time. The Neverland was pitching and heaving in 20-foot seas, riding up one gigantic wave and then slipping down the backside, only to be caught by the next and lifted up again. Towering walls of foaming seawater crashed over both ships from all directions. Stash knew he had to cut the Neverland loose from the Jolly Roger before the ships smashed each other to bits. "Back to the Jolly Roger, men!" he shouted over the roar of the wind. The pirates, eager to escape the Neverland, began leaping from one pitching deck to the other, taking whatever valuables they'd been able to scrounge from the Neverland, including a very alarmed pig.
"Captain!" shouted Smee. "What about prisoners?"
"We'll take the giant,"
replied Stash, gesturing to Little Richard, who'd finally been subdued by six pirates and was now lying beaten and bound on the deck. A man like that could be useful once he'd learned to obey.
"Take the woman, too,"
said Stash, pointing to Mrs. Bunbrake. It was Stash's policy always to take women, although this one was quite large. But a woman was a woman, the way Stash looked at it. The large woman had been sobbing uncontrollably since the girl had jumped into the water. Stash wondered about that, too. Why a girl would do such a thing.
"It had something to do with that trunk," he thought,
and that reminded him of something.
"Take Mr. Slank as well," he shouted.
He had noticed how eager Slank had been to protect the trunk. As he was shoved toward the Neverland, Slank gave Stash a cool look, and then glanced into the water where the trunk had gone over.
"He knows something about that trunk," thought Stash, "and I aim to find out what it is."
Stash had not given up on the treasure, not at all. In fact, now that he'd had it in his hands, he was more determined than ever to have it. The trunk was made of wood, and it was clearly not heavy. The boy had lifted it easily. It would float. It was in the sea, somewhere nearby. The storm would pass, and Stash would find it.
"And the others, Captain!"
shouted Smee, pointing to the rest of the Neverland's crew and passengers, a wretched, drenched lot of bedraggled sailors and small boys. Some were screaming, begging to be taken aboard the Jolly Roger, having decided it was better to be prisoner on a ship full of vicious pirates than to be left aboard the Neverland. The pounding, crashing waves were sweeping across the old ship's deck, breaking off pieces of wood. The Neverland was starting to fall apart. It would not be long now.
"Leave them to die!"
shouted Stash, and he was gratified by the looks of terror on the faces of those he had just doomed, especially the boys.
"Reef ho!"
shouted the lookout from the crow's nest of the Jolly Roger. This got Stash's attention. If the lookout could see a reef in this weather, it was very close.
"Cut them loose!"
bellowed Stash, and his men cut the lines holding the Jolly Roger to the Neverland and its wailing occupants.
"If the storm don't get them, the reef will,"
he thought happily. Stash watched as the Neverland separated and, grabbed by a wave, rose up impossibly high, then slipped over the far side of a monstrous mountain of seawater. As it disappeared from his view, he heard the wails of men mixed with the high-pitched screams of boys. A moment later, it was the Jolly Roger's turn to be lifted. As it settled, Stash cleared his eyes of the rain and saw that the Neverland was gone, lost to the sea and the spray.
"Smee!"
shouted Stash.
"Aye, Captain!"
"A reef ain't out here on its own," he said. "There'll be an island nearby, and maybe a harbour or cove where we can ride out this blow. Tell the lookout to find that island, and tell all of the crew that there's 10 gold pieces and a bottle of grog for the man who spots that trunk that went overboard."
Smee's eyes widened.
10 gold pieces, Captain.
20, if he spots that boy too.
The boy that was flying, Captain.
He wasn't flying, you idiot, roared Stash. That was a trick of the wind.
Aye, Captain. Well, if he can't fly, I reckon he's gone for sure now, in these seas.
Stop reckoning, shouted Stash, and give the crew me orders.
Aye, Captain,
said Smee, stumbling away on the pitching deck, leaving Stash staring into the raging sea. The trunk was out there, he was sure, and somehow he knew that the boy was out there too.
I'll find them both, he thought, and when I do, that boy will walk the plank. Let's see how high he can fly with cannon shot lashed to him.
Chapter 30, A Helping Hand. The third wave grabbed Peter high on his chest and yanked him down in its cold, relentless grip. As his head went under, he grabbed a breath of air, wondering if it was his last, but the churning of the water brought him up again for a moment, and he managed to get another. Then the massive weight of the wave drove him deep, tumbling him so he no longer knew which way the surface was. Seconds passed, then more seconds, and as his body continued to tumble, his chest began to burn, to ache, and as the ache turned to agony, he knew that soon he would not be able to hold his breath any longer. That was when he felt a hand grab him by the hair.
Molly!
He felt himself being pulled up, up, but before he reached the surface, his desperate lungs gave out, and he felt seawater rushing into his mouth, and then, for a while, he didn't know what was happening, and then he was gagging and coughing up seawater, and he was cold, but he was also breathing, which meant he was still alive.
Peter, are you all right?
Molly was shouting into his ear. He wanted to tell her he was all right, but he couldn't talk because of all the water coming out of him.
Peter, shouted Molly, you must hold on to me, do you understand? I can't keep us up much longer.
That was when Peter noticed he was flying again. Actually, Molly was flying and somehow holding Peter up, having draped his right arm around her shoulder. They were perhaps 25 feet above the sea now, and Peter could see, just ahead of them, the towering waves were crashing with an ungodly thunder onto what appeared to be jagged rocks. He could feel that Molly was struggling to hold him. Her voice was strained.
"Put your arms around my neck," she shouted. "There's rocks here. There might be an island, but the star stuff is wearing off and I haven't any more."
"Her locket," thought Peter. "She used her locket." Still choking up seawater, he managed to drape his arms around her neck, locking his hands together as tightly as he could. He felt Molly lean forward and felt them glide downward a bit, then swoop up. The thundering of the waves on the rocks grew louder, deafening now. Peter, trying not to think about what lay below him, concentrated on holding on to Molly, but his arms were getting weary, his hands were beginning to slip apart. Molly felt it.
"Don't let go!"
she shouted. But Peter couldn't help it. He felt his grip weakening.
"Hang on!" shouted Molly. "Just a bit more!"
But Peter couldn't hang on. He felt his cold fingers separate, and suddenly he was falling again. He heard Molly shout his name, but before she got it all out, he was plunged into the cold sea again. He managed to struggle to the surface and get his head up for an instant, and then felt himself violently hurled forward, tumbling like a leaf in a windstorm, over and over, and then he slammed into something, then again, scraping against his face. Sand. He got his feet under him, only to be knocked down and rolled by another wave, then another, and another. On hands and knees now, he crawled forward until, finally, finally, he escaped the clutching waves. Still on hands and knees, he heaved up what seemed to be an impossible amount of seawater. When he could heave no more, he tried to stand, but found that he was too weak. He put his head down on the sand, and, as the surf thundered behind him and the wind howled above, Peter fell asleep. Chapter 31, The Lagoon. Not far from where Peter lay unconscious, a lagoon connected to the sea. It was in good weather a beautiful place, a near-perfect semicircle of flawless white sand, perhaps a mile across, bordered by a curtain of tall, graceful palms. In the center of the curved beach lay 24 or so massive, sea-smooth boulders, some of them the size of a sailing ship, forming a hulking jumble of rock that stretched from the trees into the blue-green water. Behind the beach, the island rose steeply to a ridge several hundred feet high, jungle thick with vegetation, forming a curved green wall that cut the lagoon off from the rest of the island. The lagoon teemed with life. turtles, jellyfish, crabs, and vast schools of lavishly multi-hued fish. Normally, these creatures were sheltered from the surge of the sea by a coral reef. It ran across the mouth of the lagoon from one side to the other, with only a small break in the center, through which the tide flowed in and out. But the low reef was no match for the waves churned up by this storm. Every few seconds, a towering wall of wind-driven water rose high over the reef and broke upon it with a thunderous crash, sending a surge of churning, foaming water rushing high onto the beach, then back toward the sea, leaving the surf-scrubbed beach empty for a few seconds, awaiting the next incoming surge. But one of the waves left something behind. The trunk. It happened to tumble ashore in the center of the beach, becoming wedged in the sand at the base of one of the massive round boulders. The waves had taken their toll on the old wooden box. There were several cracks now, one perhaps a quarter inch wide. As the waves washed over the trunk, water seeped into the cracks, and then back out. The water seeping out was glowing, a soft greenish-gold glow, the color of fireflies. The glowing water behaved oddly. It remained next to the trunk, swirling and spiraling around it, somehow unaffected by the push and pull of the raging wave water rushing past. In time, as the storm began to subside, a large, sleek fish with a silver body and a bright green tail glided near, and then into the glowing seawater. It stopped there, hovering. It did not leave. Soon it was joined by another similar fish, and then another. They too remained in the glowing water, unable or unwilling to leave. They stayed there for hours, their fins barely moving, their gills working. At times the water changed colors. Changed and shifted, now one color, now another, now many colors, an underwater rainbow, and then the fish began to change. Chapter 32. The Wreck of the Neverland. On the heaving deck of the Neverland, James, huddled with the other boys, watched in despair as the pirates leapt back into their sleek black ship, taking a few prisoners, the lucky ones, thought James. Then the pirates cut themselves loose from the old tub. As the ship separated, the Neverland was seized by a huge wave and heaved violently skyward. James felt the deck tilt sharply. He then fell, hearing the screams of the other boys, Prentice, Thomas, and, loudest of all, Tubby Ted, as they too lost their footing on the sloping, slippery deck. Grown men screamed as well as the ship reached the top of the mountain of water and began to slide down the other side, faster and faster, tilting now at an impossible angle. The Neverland broke apart. Whole sections of the deck tearing loose, the mast splintering like twigs. A crewman was pitched screaming into the sea. He was followed by another, and then another. James felt himself sliding with the other boys toward the ship's downside rail, toward the angry sea, all of them flailing desperately, trying to grab onto something. By the look of things, James knew that soon enough there would be no ship at all. "Here, lad!" boomed a voice from behind him. "Over here!" James turned his head and saw the big crewman, Peter's friend, Alf, holding out a massive hand. James grabbed hold of it and felt himself hauled away from the rail. The big man managed to rescue the other boys as well, hauling them toward him, somehow keeping them all from sliding off the ship.
"Hold on to each other, lads," he shouted. "There's a dory this way."
He jerked his head toward the stern.
"Hurry!"
Clinging to each other, Alf and the boys half crawled, half stumbled to the stern, where a battered dory tumbled back and forth on the deck, held tenuously onto the deck by a frayed line.
"Get in, lads," shouted Alf, untying the line. "I'll put you over the side."
Prentice and Thomas clambered into the dory, but Tubby Ted pulled away, screaming,
"I'm not getting in that little boat."
"Hurry," bellowed Alf. "The next wave puts us on the reef."
"Get in,"
shouted James, grabbing Tubby Ted's shirt and yanking him so that they both fell backward into the dory. James's head slammed against the side. Momentarily stunned, he felt Alf shoving the dory, then heard shouts and screams as another huge wave rose high over the ship and crashed onto the deck, sending the dory shooting overboard and, at the same time, dashing the Neverland against the reef, instantly splintering the old ship into hundreds, thousands of pieces. The dory capsized the instant it hit the water, but somehow the four boys managed to hang on, scrambling out from under, clinging to the little boat's rough bottom. James looked frantically around for Alf, but saw only barrels and pieces of wood, shards of the ship tossing in the churning sea. For an hour, 2 hours, they clung to the side of the little boat as the sea swept it one way then another, rain pounding down on them, the smaller boys crying, James trying to comfort them. At last the rain stopped and the waves diminished. Although the sea was still rough, the sky began to clear, first to grey, then to a bright blue, and still the little boat drifted, drifted, and then...
"What's that?"
Prentice said. James looked where Prentice was pointing and saw it looming on the horizon.
"Something big," he said. "That's a mountain," said Prentice. "Land!" shouted Thomas. "Is there food?" asked Tubby Ted. "Start kicking," James ordered.
And they kicked, their excitement momentarily driving the fatigue from their limbs. They kept kicking, but after a few minutes their exhaustion started to return, as it became clear they weren't making much progress. The mountain looked as far away as before, maybe farther. The random powerful thrusts of the sea were far more powerful than their puny legs.
"We'll never get there," said Prentice, sniffling. "We're going to drown, our dear."
"No, we're not,"
reprimanded James, but he feared Prentice was right. He kept kicking, but one by one the others quit, too tired to continue. James saw now that it was no use. The mountain was at a different angle now. The sea was going to carry them past it. James closed his eyes, fighting tears, fighting despair.
"Need some help, lads?"
The boys spun their heads so fast they almost lost their hold on the dory. There, behind them, clinging to a barrel, was Alf, smiling.
"What do you say we go ashore, lads?" he said.
"We can't, sir," said James. "We've been trying, but we can't."
"Let old Alf give you a hand,"
said the big man, letting go of the barrel and swimming to the bow of the dory.
"Where's that line? Ah, here we go."
With practiced sailor's hands, Alf quickly tied the line around his chest.
"Hang on,"
he said, pushing off and swimming with clumsy but strong strokes toward the island. The boys felt the dory moving and hope returning. It took a good hour more. Alf had to stop and rest repeatedly, but finally they were close enough to the island to see trees and then a beach. And in another few minutes, Alf put his feet down and stood, and the boys cheered in gratitude to Alf and the Almighty, in that order, as he dragged the tiny boat across a shallow lagoon to the edge of the beach. James jumped off and ran onto the sand, falling on his knees.
"We're safe!"
he shouted.
"I hope you're right," said Alf.
The boys looked at the big man.
"What do you mean?" asked Prentice. "Aren't we safe here?"
"That depends," said Alf.
"Depends on what?"
asked James.
Looking off into the dense jungle, Alf said,
"On who else is here?"
Chapter 33. Land Ho. The Jolly Roger pitched and heaved in the rolling seas as sunrise broke in a cloudless sky, the storm now past. A shifty fog had settled in the wake of the storm. The Jolly Roger cut in and out of it like ducking behind a curtain. Black Stash, still wearing the British captain's uniform, climbed onto deck, with Smee following close behind. Stash rubbed the weariness out of his eyes and released a ferocious belch. Then he froze as an opening in the fog gave him a clear view starboard. At that moment, the shout came from the crow's nest.
"Land ho!"
"All hands on deck!"
Stash hollered, and the disheveled crew, sleepless after a nerve-wracking, storm-tossed night, stumbled onto the deck in ones and twos. They smiled at the welcome sight of the mountainous island, its lush greenery beckoning.
"Heave to, men!" shouted Stash. "Hoist the main and hard to starboard. Fresh water and coconuts within the hour."
The sailors cheered, setting eagerly to work, as Smee needlessly repeated the orders. The Jolly Roger quickly drew close to the island, rounding a point of land that opened onto what looked like a fine lagoon anchorage. Stash raised his spyglass, scanning for rocks or reefs ahead, and saw none. Then he aimed the glass at the beach, a line of footsteps in the sand.
"Smee,"
he said,
"ready a landing party at once." "Shut up, so I can hear,"
Slank kicked Little Richard, who was snoring at the top of his sizable lungs. Little Richard snorted awake, a line of drool from his chin to the floor of the cage where he and Slank were locked in the lowest hold of the Jolly Roger. The cage was the ship's brig, but it had been used as a livestock cage. In fact, Slank and Little Richard were sharing it now with a pig and a cow, neither of which seemed happy with its new cellmates. The two animals huddled together by the cell door, opposite the two men. Because of the livestock, the brig had reeked when the men were thrown inside, but the stench was even worse now because Little Richard had been sick in the storm.
"What is it?"
said Little Richard, sitting up.
"Quiet," said Slank. "They're shouting."
He pressed his ear to the low, damp ceiling, concentrating. Then,
"They've spotted land.
Land? Said Little Richard.
But we're 1,000 leagues from nowhere.
Must be an island, said Slank.
Time for us to get off this ship.
How? Said Little Richard, looking at the iron bars surrounding them.
We can't bend these.
They tried that during the night, both of them gripping a bar and straining against it with all their might. But even Little Richard's massive muscles were no match for the brig's bars.
I've got an idea, said Slank. Give me your belt.
My belt? Said Little Richard.
Just give it to me,
snapped Slank, taking off his own belt. He joined the two belts then, standing next to the cow, passed the belts around two of the iron bars of the cell door. The cow shifted nervously, trying to move away, but Slank grabbed the rope around its neck and quickly tied it to the belts.
Do you see now?
Slank asked.
All I see is a cow tied to the cage, said Little Richard.
To the cage door, corrected Slank.
When the cow jerks away, it'll yank the door open.
But what's going to make the cow jerk away? Asked Little Richard.
You're going to milk it, said Slank.
But I don't know how to milk a cow, said Little Richard.
Exactly, said Slank.
Chapter 34. Reunited. Peter awoke face down with sand in his mouth and a bird on his head. When he spat out the sand, the bird squawked and fluttered into the air, landing a few yards away on the beach, disappointed at having lost its comfortable perch in Peter's thick red hair. Still spitting sand, Peter stood unsteadily and looked around him, blinking, almost blinded by the glare of the bright sun on the white sand. The beach, curving gently around a deep water lagoon, stretched out several hundred yards in each direction. Ahead of him, maybe 50 yards away, was a line of palm trees. Beyond that, the land rose steeply, thick with green vegetation. He looked at the bird, which was looking back at him.
"Can you tell me where I am?" Peter asked.
The bird said nothing.
"I didn't think so," said Peter.
He itched all over. He was hungry. His throat burned from swallowing seawater. He began trudging toward the trees. His plan was to climb into the hills, looking for a stream. There had to be water, he figured, with all this greenery. But he was still weak from his ordeal at sea, and when he reached the palms, he decided to rest a bit. He sat beneath a tree, his back against its rough grey bark, and closed his eyes. He opened them when he felt a shadow fall on his face.
"Hello, Peter," said Molly.
"Molly," said Peter, scrambling to his feet. "It's you!"
This immediately struck Peter as an exceptionally stupid thing for him to have told Molly, but she didn't seem to notice.
"Yes," she said. "It's me. Are you all right?"
"Yes," said Peter, brushing some sand off his clothes. "I'm fine, and you...
He stammered to a stop, his face red.
"What is it, Peter?"
"I mean, thank you, Molly, for saving me."
Molly took a step forward and put her hand on Peter's arm. This felt absolutely wonderful to Peter. He cast his eyes down lest she see the effect she was having.
"Peter," she said, "it's I who should be thanking you. You helped me when I desperately needed help. You got the trunk off the ship. You risked your life for me. The least I could do was to try to keep you from drowning. I'm only sorry I let you fall."
"That wasn't your fault," said Peter. "I couldn't hold on any longer."
"After you fell," Molly said, "I began to descend, and fortunately the wind drove me onto this island not far from here. I've been searching since then, hoping that you were... I mean, I was so worried, Peter, and when I saw you against the tree, I..."
Now it was Molly's turn to cast her eyes downward. After an awkward silence, Peter said,
"Have you seen a stream? I'm awfully thirsty." "No stream, not yet," said Molly, "but I think I've found water."
"What do you mean?"
"On the beach, just a bit that way," said Molly, pointing. "There's a barrel. It looks like a water barrel from the Neverland."
"The Neverland?"
said Peter, suddenly remembering. "Do you think it was? I mean, James and them, do you think..."
Molly's look was somber.
"I don't know, Peter," she said. "All we can do is hope they're all right. But for now, we need to look after ourselves."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, for starters, we should get that water barrel off the beach before the tide takes it back out to sea. We'll need it if we can't find any other water. We'll also need to find food sooner or later, and most important, we need to look for the trunk."
"Really?" said Peter. "You think it could have ended up on this island?"
"The barrel ended up here, didn't it?"
"True," said Peter.
"Let's go get that barrel," said Molly. Then we'll climb this hill and have a look round at what else is on this island. The barrel was full and heavy. It took all their strength to roll it up the beach. It was sealed with a thick cork stopper, which Peter managed with considerable effort to dislodge by banging it with a sharp piece of coral. The water was warm and brackish, but they both drank greedily. Then, at Molly's insistence, they dragged the barrel into a depression in the land and covered it with fallen palm fronds. Then she made them back away from the hidden barrel, using fronds to sweep away their footprints. "Why are we being so careful?" Peter asked. "There's nobody here but us."
"That's true now," said Molly. "But somebody may come, and I don't want them taking our water."
When she was satisfied that the barrel was hidden, she and Peter set off inland. They soon found themselves struggling up a steep mountainside thick with vegetation. Trees, vines, bushes bearing large, sweet-smelling yellow flowers. Insects hummed around their ears. Birds twittered and screeched in the tree canopy above them. At times the vegetation was so thick Peter couldn't see Molly a few feet ahead of him. At times he couldn't even see his feet. He wondered if there might be snakes. It certainly looked as though there might be snakes. But he did not voice this thought, as he didn't want Molly, forging resolutely ahead, to think he was scared. After about 45 minutes of hard climbing, they emerged onto an open rocky plateau from which they could look back and see where they'd been. They were several hundred feet up now, looking down on the lagoon where Peter had come ashore. Peter could see the gouge in the sand they'd made when they dragged the water barrel up the beach. To the far right-hand side, a ridge jutted into the sea, separating Peter's lagoon from another, shallower one, with a wide beach that...
"What was that?" "Molly," said Peter, pointing toward the far lagoon. "Look!"
Molly squinted, shading her eyes.
"It's a boat," she exclaimed. "A little boat, and people! I see 3, 4, 5 of them!"
Peter strained to make out the distant dark shapes on the white beach.
"It looks like 4 smallish ones and 1 biggish one, he said. "Oh, Molly, do you think it's James and them?"
Molly studied the shapes some more.
"Yes," she said, "it's definitely them, and a crewman. I believe it's your friend, the big one."
"Alf?" said Peter, his heart soaring.
"Even Alf was alive. Let's go down to meet them."
"Yes," said Molly, suddenly serious.
"And we had better hurry."
Peter, hearing the change in her tone, looked at Molly and saw alarm in her face.
"What is it?" he said. "See for yourself,"
she said, pointing off to the left. Peter looked and saw it instantly. A ship heading straight toward the lagoon where he'd come ashore. A black ship flying the Jolly Roger. Chapter 35. Into the Jungle.
"Come on then, lads," said Alf, trudging up the beach.
Behind him, walking single file and glancing nervously at the line of palm trees ahead, were James, Prentice, Thomas, and Tubby Ted.
"Sir,"
James asked,
"what are we going to do?"
"We're going to look for water," said Alf.
"And food,"
said Tubby Ted.
"Water first," said Alf. "We can go days without food."
"We can what?"
shouted Tubby Ted.
"Keep your voice down," said Alf. "We might have company on this island."
What kind of company?" asked Prentice.
"I don't know," said Alf.
"But some of these islands is inhabited by savages."
The word hung in the air. Savages.
"Sir," Thomas said, "are savages bad?"
"Not all of them, no," Alf answered. "Some are just, what's the word, primitive, like big children."
"What about the others?" said Prentice.
"Well," said Alf, "I've heard stories about sailors who were shipwrecked on islands just like this, and the savages come and grabbed them and put them in a big pot."
Why did they do that?"
asked Prentice. Alf stopped, looked back.
"Why do you think?" he said.
You mean they ate them?"
said Prentice.
"Like a Christmas pudding,"
said Alf, resuming his trudge toward the tree line. The boys were quiet now, thinking unpleasant thoughts, except for Tubby Ted, who was torn between unpleasant thoughts and pudding. They reached the palm trees and explored the area a bit. That is, Alf explored the area, with the boys staying as close as possible to his reassuring bulk. They found nothing of interest, no water, no food, no footprints.
"That's it, then," said Alf. "We'll have to go in there."
He nodded toward the green wall of vegetation covering the mountainous slope, rising away from the beach. The boys peered apprehensively at the impenetrable facade of the jungle.
But, sir, said Thomas, what if there's savages in there?
We got to chance that, said Alf. If we don't find water, we'll die, and then the crabs will eat us just as sure as savages would.
He started forward, shoving his big frame through the thick mass of vines. They closed behind him like a green curtain, and suddenly he was out of sight. His muffled voice came back to the boys.
You lads coming?
The boys looked at one another, all thinking the same thing. They didn't want to go into the jungle, but they also didn't want to be separated from Alf. James, grimacing, pushed his way through the vine curtain, followed reluctantly but very closely by Prentice, Thomas, and Tubby Ted. As the vines closed behind them, they found themselves in a world quite different from the brilliantly sunlit beach. The sun barely pierced the thick tree canopy above them, its light weakened to a kind of green dusk. The vegetation around them was so thick that they could not see more than a few feet in any direction, and sometimes not even that. There was no path, no opening, only the random riot of the vines and trees, and within a few steps James could not be sure which way they had come from and which way they were going. What was more alarming was that he also did not see Alf.
Sir!
Said James.
Sir!
This way!
Came Alf's voice, even more muffled now, more distant.
Come in, sir,
said James, pushing in the direction he thought the voice had come from. Behind him, Prentice said,
I can't see anything. Nor I,
said James. From the rear, Tubby Ted said,
there could be anything in here with us, and we wouldn't see it. There could be lions.
Don't be stupid, said James. There's no lions.
How do you know that?
Said Tubby Ted.
'Cause it's an island. Lions don't live on islands. There could be gorillas, said Tubby Ted.
What's gillers? Said Prentice.
Gorillas, said Tubby Ted. Big, hairy jungle things. They swing through the trees and grab you and take you to their nests.
Gorillas don't have nests, said James.
Course they do, you git, said Tubby Ted. Why do you think they live in trees?
James could not think of a good answer to that. He glanced up at the tree canopy, thick and dark and close. Prentice caught the glance and his eyes followed it.
Why do the gorillas, why do they take you to their nest? He said.
You don't want to know,
said Tubby Ted, meaning, of course, that he was about to tell them.
They crack open your head like a coconut, then they feed your brains to the baby gorillas.
Prentice and Thomas looked horrified.
They do not, said James.
Yes, they do, said Tubby Ted. And then they take your eyes and they...
Shut up, said James.
I want to go back to the beach, said Prentice. Me too, said Thomas.
We're not going back there, said James.
We're staying with Alf.
At that moment, all the boys had the same thought. Where was Alf?
Sir,
called James.
Sir!
There was no answer.
Sir, can you hear me, sir?
Nothing. Now they were all shouting as loud as they could, but nothing came back to them but the hum and whine of unseen insects.
I want to go back to the beach, repeated Prentice.
All right, then, said James. We'll go back to the beach and we'll wait for Alf. When he sees we're missing, he'll come back and find us.
If the gorillas don't get him, said Tubby Ted, or us.
Shut up, said James.
All right, we'll...
James looked around him. In every direction, he could see perhaps 6 feet. In every direction, everything looked the same. Which way was the beach? James looked around for a moment, feeling the weight of the other boy's eyes on him.
All right, then,
he said, shouldering his way through the vegetation. This way. The unyielding jungle made the going tiring. The weariness James felt in his arms and legs was worsened by the feeling, growing stronger in his gut each minute, that he had gotten them seriously lost. He couldn't tell if he was going in a straight line. He sometimes had the feeling he was walking somewhere that he'd already been, but there was no way to be sure in the unrelenting sameness of the jungle. Behind him he heard Prentice and Thomas crying softly, and Tubby Ted's labored breathing as he struggled to keep up.
Tubby Ted's too tired even to talk, James thought. That's one good thing come of all this.
As they walked, James regularly shouted for Alf, but there was no response. Every few minutes the boys stopped to rest, and James would try to cheer up the others. But more and more he saw hopelessness on their faces, as well as growing exhaustion on Tubby Ted's. More and more James had to speak sternly to get them moving again. He struggled to stay calm, but as he stumbled forward through the clinging vines, the fears were multiplying in his mind. What if they were still lost when night fell? It was dark enough now, but he shuddered at the thought of being surrounded by this jungle in pitch blackness.
"Elf!"
he shouted for the hundredth time, and for the hundredth time he got no answer.
"All right, then,"
he said, stopping again. "Let's rest here for a bit." He turned reluctantly, not wanting to see the disheartened faces of the others, but feeling the burden of command.
"I wish Peter were here."
Behind him, Prentice and Thomas were sitting in a dense growth of low ferns on the jungle floor, their heads down. Tubby Ted wasn't there.
"Ted?"
said James.
"Ted! Do you hear me, Ted?"
Nothing.
"Wasn't Ted right behind you?"
James asked Thomas, fighting to keep the panic he was feeling out of his voice.
"He was, last time I looked,"
said Thomas.
"When was that?"
said James.
"I don't know," said Thomas. "A few minutes ago." "You didn't hear anything?"
said James.
"No,"
said Thomas, sobbing now.
"What if a gorilla got him?"
That got Prentice crying too.
"Stop it, you two," said James. "Now listen, it wasn't any gorilla. Tubby Ted probably tripped and fell, is all. We have to go back and find him."
"I don't want to go back,"
said Prentice.
"I just want to get out of there."
"Me too," said Thomas. "I'm not going back where there's gorillas." "There's no gorillas,"
said James.
"You don't know that,"
said Thomas.
"You don't even know where we are. I'm not going back."
"Me neither,"
said Prentice.
"All right then,"
said James.
"All right, you stay here. I'm going to go back just a few steps and have a look."
"No,"
said Prentice.
"You'll get lost."
"I won't,"
said James.
"I'll be careful. Just a few steps. Stay right here.
Don't move. You understand?"
Prentice and Thomas nodded. James edged past where they were sitting and pushed his way back in the direction they'd come from. He followed the broken leaves and branches, walking for perhaps a minute. Then he paused and shouted,
"Ted! Ted! Answer me, Ted!"
Nothing. James looked back and called,
"Prentice! Thomas! Can you hear me?"
"Yes!"
The two voices were muted, but not far off. James decided to backtrack a little farther.
"Just a few more steps."
He pushed on a short distance, then shouted again,
"Ted! Ted, it's James! Can you hear me? Answer me!"
Nothing. Not daring to venture any farther away from Prentice and Thomas, James turned back. He trudged a few yards and shouted,
"Prentice! Thomas!"
Nothing. James's spine went cold.
"Prentice! Thomas! That's not funny! Answer me!"
Nothing. Now James was running, stumbling forward, shouting. In a minute he reached what he judged to be the place where he'd left them. There was nobody there.
Maybe it's the wrong place.
But it wasn't the wrong place. He could see two flattened areas in the fern patch where Prentice and Thomas had sat. This was where they'd been.
"Prentice! Thomas! Answer me!"
Where had they gone?
Alone now, no longer trying to hide his fear, James whirled in circles, shouting, looking, but seeing only the dark green blur of the jungle. Finally, exhausted, he dropped to his knees, then onto his stomach in the thick, soft ferns. Then he put his face in his hands and cried, big, chest-racking sobs, until he couldn't cry any more. He lay there, face in hands, trying to imagine that he could wish everything away, so that when he opened his eyes, it would all be gone. The pirates, the shipwreck, and especially this awful jungle, gone. Everything gone, but his friends. But when he opened his eyes, the jungle was still there, surrounding him with its ominous, gloomy silence. Now, as James's eyes adjusted, as he raised his face from the ferns, he saw that there was something else right there in front of him. Two pairs of very large, very brown, bare feet.
Chapter 36. Getting Close.
Molly and Peter found it tough going. The lower they descended on the mountain slope, the denser the vegetation, until they almost felt as though they were swimming in it rather than walking through it. With visibility limited to only a few feet and with no way to take their bearings, they couldn't be sure if they were still going in the right direction. As the mountain slope became more gentle, they had trouble determining which way was downhill. They found themselves stopping more and more, unsure which way to go. Let's yell for them, said Peter. They can't be far off now.
No yelling, Molly said. There are pirates about, and for all we know, there may be others here as well.
What others? Said Peter.
I don't know, said Molly, but I'd prefer to find out about them before they find out about us.
And so, having determined, they hoped which way was downward, they pushed on. Impossibly, the jungle grew even thicker. There were times when Peter, only 2 steps behind Molly, could not see her. And that was why, when he pushed through a particularly lush curtain of hanging moss, he bumped into her back. Oops, he said. Sorry, I...
Shh,
she said, putting her hand on his arm.
Listen.
Peter listened. He heard nothing.
What?
He whispered.
I heard somebody shouting, she said. From that way.
She gestured in roughly the direction they'd been walking.
Shouting what?
Said Peter.
I couldn't make it out, she said. But it wasn't a man's voice. It was a boy's.
That's them, said Peter. He was stopped from shouting by Molly's hand clapped over his mouth.
Shh,
she said, then removed her hand.
But why?
Whispered Peter.
Because, said Molly with exaggerated patience, as we were discussing 1 minute ago, there are pirates about.
But they're nowhere near here, said Peter.
You don't know that,
said Molly. Peter, unable to think of a good answer, settled for looking annoyed.
All right, then, said Molly. We'll go toward the shout, but we'll go quietly. Agreed?
Peter said nothing. He wasn't sure about taking orders from her.
Good,
said Molly, moving again. You worry too much, Peter said to her back. She stopped, turned and faced him, her index finger pressed to her lips. And then he too heard it. Voices in the distance. But speaking a language he'd never heard before. Grunts and clicks. Whoever they weren't pirates. Peter wasn't sure they were human. Chapter 37. Heavy Like a Trunk. The towering mountain of rock and jungle engulfed in soft white mist rose before Stash's vision like an altar.
Beautiful, ain't she?
Stash said in a moment of uncharacteristic reverence. He jumped from the longboat into the now gentler surf and trudged to the beach, his boots squishing wetly. Behind him, Smee and a dozen of Stash's best men hopped out as well and dragged the long rowboat up onto the white sand. Stash, followed by the others, strode quickly to the line of footprints he'd seen from the deck of the Jolly Roger.
"Here they are," he said. "Smee, what do you make of this?"
Smee came puffing up and examined the sand.
"Footprints," he said.
"I know they're footprints," said Stash. "What's between the footprints, Smee?"
Said Smee, squinting.
"Something's been dragged."
"Very good, Mr. Smee," said Stash. "And how much does this something weigh?"
"Heavy,"
said Smee.
"Yes, heavy,"
Stash smiled, his twisted black moustache turning at the edges with a grin.
"Heavy, like a trunk?"
"A trunk,"
said Smee. Then after a pause he said,
"Say, Captain, wasn't you looking for a trunk?"
"Of course I am, you seagull-brained cretin,"
bellowed Stash.
"The trunk is why we're on this bleeding island."
Then, calming somewhat, he turned to the pirates and said,
"Looks like we'll be taking a walk through the jungle, men."
"It looks a mite thick, don't it, Captain?"
asked one of the pirates, hesitantly.
"Could be all manner of snakes in there, waiting to chomp on our legs."
"An excellent point," said Stash. "That's why you shall go first."
The pirate's face fell, but he dared not say any more.
"No,"
said Stash, looking at another of the men and pointing to the footprints.
"How many do you figure?"
The man dropped to one knee and studied the sand.
"A bit confusing it is," he said. "Might be 2, might be 4, and..."
He turned and pointed to the pirate's prints in the sand.
"I'd say they ain't half the weight of us neither, Captain. Children, I'd say."
"Children," said Stash, his face darkening. "That cursed boy!"
"But Captain,"
Smee said.
"I don't see how, in that storm..."
"It's him!"
thundered Stash.
"Him and that girl! They're on this island!"
"Yes, Captain,"
said Smee. Stash pointed to the man he designated as Snakebait.
"Get moving,"
he said, pointing up the beach at the waiting jungle.
We've got a chunk to find, and a boy to kill.
Chapter 38, The Transformation. In the lagoon the fish were still hovering. There were 9 of them, all females, and for hours they'd barely moved other than make small efficient motions with their bodies to counteract the ebb and flow of the wave surge, and thus keep themselves bathed in the glowing green-gold water. They hadn't moved much, but they were changing, and fast. They still had their tails, though these had grown longer and more graceful. In their midsections their bodies narrowed and their skin changed abruptly from rough green scales to a white, fleshy smoothness. This fleshy, forward section now grew larger. A distinct head appeared, separating from the trunk by a slender neck. The eyes, originally on opposite sides of the head, moved closer together. The mouth became smaller, and a bulge of flesh started to protrude above it. Ears were sprouting on each side of the head. On the trunk, the dorsal fin now shrank, absorbed by the body, while the pectoral fins stretched longer, with the ends splaying into distinct fingers of tissue. These creatures were not human. Their features were still crude, their flesh startlingly white, their eyes huge, shining, almost luminescent. No, they weren't human, but they were no longer fish either. And with each moment as their bodies became less fish-like, so did their brains. No longer were they thinking only in simple survival urges. Move, eat, fight, flee. Now their thoughts were far more self-aware and complex, and more these thoughts centered on the cause of their wondrous transformation. They were thinking about the trunk. Chapter 39, Escape. Little Richard was drenched in milk and the cow was none too happy, but the iron brig door hung open.
"Good job," said Slank.
"Next time you milk the cow," said Little Richard.
Slank led the way quietly out of the cell. A few yards away was another cell. In it lay Mrs. Bumbrake, sound asleep, snoring. Slank barely glanced at her as he led Little Richard through the ship's stores. They entered a narrow corridor where Little Richard's huge bulk touched both walls, and then came to a ladder which led up to the Jolly Roger's galley. The ship's cook never saw them coming. He became aware of them only when he felt Little Richard's enormous paw pick him up by the neck and toss him casually down the ladderway like a sack of flour. With that taken care of, Little Richard, always hungry, grabbed a loaf of bread and stuffed it whole into his mouth. Slank, meanwhile, looked for weapons, grabbing several knives and handing Little Richard a massive iron skillet. Thus armed, they headed back toward the ladderway. Slank knew that, with Stash gone, the crew would be slacking. Most likely, the only man awake would be the lookout.
"You head straight to the crow's nest," he whispered to Little Richard. "Bonk him on the head quietly."
Little Richard nodded. They poked their heads out into the fresh salt air. Sure enough, the crew were sprawled helter-skelter on the deck, snoozing in the sunshine. Nothing moved but a scrawny red chicken. Little Richard pushed past Slank, and with astonishing stealth for his bulk, slipped over to the mainmast and began to climb. A minute later, Slank heard the thunk of the skillet. The lookout was now napping as well. With a kitchen knife, Slank quietly cut some strips of sailcloth and lengths of rope. Then he and Little Richard took care of the rest of the crew, one by one. The big man would clap his huge hand over a sleeping pirate's mouth, holding him firmly while Slank quickly gagged and bound him. When the pirates had all been subdued, Little Richard, feeling prankish, hoisted and slung them over the main boom like human laundry hung out to dry. There was dark fury in the eyes of the pirates, thoroughly humiliated by being taken prisoner, without a fight, on their own ship by 2 men. But there was nothing the pirates could do. They weren't going anywhere, and Black Stash no longer had any backup from his ship. While Little Richard was hanging the laundry, Slank located 4 pistols and 2 swords. Then, with the pirates watching sullenly, Little Richard single-handedly lowered a dory, normally the job of 4 men, over the starboard rail, where it couldn't be seen from the island. Little Richard climbed over the rail and slid on a rope down to the boat. As Slank prepared to do the same, he turned toward the glaring pirates, blew them a dainty kiss, and shouted, "Ta-ta, ladies!" Turning his back to them, he reached beneath his shirt and pulled out a gold locket, checking to be sure the chain was intact. He replaced it, grabbed the rope, and slid down to the boat where Richard was already at the oars. Slank cast off. Little Richard dug the oars into the water and gave a mighty backward heave. The dory shot forward. Slank reached down and touched the blade of his sword.
A thin line of blood instantly appeared on his thumb.
Nice and sharp.
As they rounded the stern of the Jolly Roger, the island came into view. The longboat Stash had used to go ashore was pulled up on the beach, but there were no men in sight.
"Take us straight in,"
Slank commanded, his hand on the sword handle.
"We have an appointment with Mr. Stash."
Chapter 40. Captured. James stared, fear frozen at the feet in front of his face. They were like no feet he'd ever seen before, sun-bronzed, calloused, with long curling yellow toenails. Not Alf's feet, not pirate feet either.
Savages.
For several eternal seconds, James kept his eyes on the feet, too terrified to lift his head and look at their owners. His body was rigid with terror as he waited for the savages to do something horrible to him, bash his head with clubs, or stab him with spears, or tap him on the shoulder. James flinched violently when the finger touched him. From above, he heard chortling.
"They're laughing."
Slowly James raised his head, taking in two pairs of sturdy brown legs, leading up to two filthy loincloths made of some kind of woven fiber, then two muscular torsos, and finally, the faces of his captors. They were young men in their mid-twenties, one slightly taller than the other. Their faces, framed by shoulder-length jet-black hair, were enough alike that the men could have been brothers. Both had high cheekbones, jutting angular noses, and dark, deep-set eyes. They did, in fact, have spears, dark wooden shafts topped with bright pink tips, apparently fashioned from sharpened shells. But they held the spears upright, and their bemused expressions told James that they weren't planning to stab him. Not right now, anyway. For a moment, James regarded the savages, and they him. Then the taller one made a lifting gesture with his nun-spear hand, which James understood to mean that he was to stand. Legs trembling, he stood. Immediately, the shorter man turned and slipped into the jungle. The taller one gestured that James was to follow his companion. James stumbled forward, trying to keep up with the shorter man, who seemed to move effortlessly through the thick vegetation. The taller man followed close behind James, occasionally prodding him with a finger when they fell too far behind. They walked in silence, not stopping for maybe 15 minutes. James couldn't tell how the savages knew where they were going, but clearly they did, because suddenly they came to a large clearing, roughly circular, easily 200 feet across. In the center of the clearing was a cluster of enormous trees, unlike any James had seen. Their stout branches extending outward horizontally were supported by thick, root-like shoots that reached down into the ground, forming a labyrinth of columns surrounding the massive main tree trunks. James could see people moving around in the shadowy interior of the tree fortress. There appeared to be dozens of them, dark-haired and brown-skinned like his captors, men and women, some of them children. They were speaking, but in a strange language that consisted mostly of guttural sounds and a strange clicking noise. As James neared the trees, his attention was drawn to a place at the far end of the clearing. There, a half a dozen men holding spears were loosely gathered around a small group of people seated on the ground. One large person and three small ones.
Alf and the boys.
James' knees went weak with relief. Prodded unnecessarily by the savage behind him, he stumbled toward his mates, who turned toward him as he approached. He saw worry on Alf's face and fear on those of Prentice Thomas and Tubby Ted. James, suddenly aware of his exhaustion, plopped down next to Prentice. The two savages who'd captured him exchanged a rapid series of odd sounds with the others in the circle. Then they fell silent, watching the captives expressionlessly. Alf glanced up at the men, then turned to James.
"You all right, lad?" he whispered.
"Yes, sir," said James.
He turned to the other boys.
"You all right?"
"I'm scared,"
said Prentice, his voice shaking.
"When you left to look for Ted, they came out of nowhere, and they..."
He stopped, his shoulders shaking with sobs. James put his arm around Prentice and said,
"It's okay. We'll be okay."
"Oh, right," sneered Tubby Ted. "We'll be just fine."
James shot Tubby Ted a be-quiet look, but Ted wasn't finished.
"You got us into this," he said. "You said we should go into this stupid jungle, and now look where you've got us. Captured by savages, thanks to you, we'll be killed and eaten."
Now Prentice and James were both sobbing.
"Ted,"
said James, his voice low but furious,
"if you keep that up, I'll kill you myself, you understand? We don't know what they plan to do. So far, they haven't done anything to us. They may be friendly, right?
Alf?
The boys looked at Alf.
Right, said Alf, not at all believably. They could be very friendly.
Then why did they capture us?
Whispered Prentice.
Why are they watching us like this? What are they going to do?
I don't know, said Alf, but I aim to talk to them.
But how, sir? Said James.
They make those noises.
I know, said Alf, but I've heard some tales in my time about how you talk to a savage. The trick is, keep it simple.
What do you mean?
Said James.
Watch, said Alf.
Slowly he got to his feet. The savages shifted a bit, getting closer to him, but not stopping him. Alf faced the savage closest to him, an older man, perhaps in his 40s. Solemnly, Alf raised his right hand, palm out.
How?
He said. The savage studied Alf for a moment, then turned and grunt-clicked something to his comrades, who laughed. Then the savage turned back to Alf, and transferring his spear to his left hand, raised his right hand and said,
Ow.
Alf looked quite surprised.
Now what?
Whispered James.
I don't know,
said Alf. He hadn't really planned it out. His mind raced frantically, but nothing came. Finally, he decided to stick with what had been working so far. He raised his palm again.
Ow,
he said. This elicited more grunts and clicks from the older savage to his co-savages, who responded with more laughter. The older savage then turned to Alf again and again raised his hand and uttered another solemn,
How?
Alf pondered his next move. On the one hand, the savages seemed to be responding reasonably well to How. On the other hand, they really weren't making much progress.
At least they're not eating us, he thought.
10 seconds went by, then 20, as Alf looked at the older savage, and the older savage looked at Alf. Finally, out of sheer nervousness and unable to think of what else to do, Alf raised his right hand again, but this time, just as Alf began to speak, the savage rotated his spear from the vertical to the horizontal, pointing it toward Alf's chest. Alf stopped in mid-how, staring at the sharp pink spear tip inches from his heart, and then the savage spoke. Poking his spear tip against Alf's chest, he said,
Can we move this conversation along, old chap? I'm getting frightfully tired of how.
Chapter 41 To the Rescue. Peter was barely breathing now. He was right behind Molly, the two of them moving slowly, slowly through the thicket of vines, placing each footstep with excruciating care, lest they break a fallen branch and give themselves away. They were very near the voices which were coming from a clearing just ahead. Most of it was the strange grunts and clicks, but twice there had been another low, distinct voice, and both times Molly had turned back and mouthed the name, Alf. Now Molly stopped. She'd reached the edge of the thicket and was carefully pushing some vines aside, making a slit to see through. Peter moved close, looking over her shoulder, careful not to touch her, but very aware of the fact that he liked the way her neck smelled. As the vines parted, Peter's attention was drawn from Molly's neck to the clearing, which was dominated by a huge tree, actually a group of trees, in the center, protected by a thicket of odd vertical pole-like growths descending from the branches. Moving among these poles were brown-skinned, black-haired people, the men wearing only loincloths, the women in slightly more modest loose shifts, the smaller children happily naked.
Peter,
whispered Molly, nodding toward the right.
Look!
Peter looked, and his heart jumped. There, perhaps 50 feet away, a half-dozen spear-wielding men were surrounding his mates, James, Prentice, Thomas, and Tubby Ted. Alf was there too, but the big man was standing, holding his right hand up, speaking to the oldest-looking of the men. Whatever he said, it apparently was the wrong thing, because suddenly the savage was pointing his spear directly at Alf's chest.
He's going to kill Alf, whispered Peter. We've got to stop him.
How?
Said Molly.
I don't know,
said Peter, moving toward the right, keeping just outside the clearing.
We'll think of something.
We'd better think of something.
Chapter 42 It's Here. Little Richard slipped into the waves without a splash, a difficult job for a man so big, and dragged the dory ashore alongside Stash's longboat. Slank, a sword and 2 pistols stuck into his belt, waited for the boat to hit sand,
and then hopped out into the shallow water. He strode to the sand, knelt on one knee, and studied the pattern of prints in the sand.
2, maybe 4 children.
Black Stash and his men behind them.
He pointed out to the thick groove in the sand.
Somebody was dragging something heavy.